Artemis II is closer to flight, and Voyager's thrusters get a deep space fix. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA is one step closer to sending humans into deep space once again. Lockheed Martin delivered the Orion spacecraft for NASA's Artemis II mission. Now the agency is preparing the vehicle for the more than 10-day flyby of our moon that will carry a crew of four. We'll speak with Lockheed Martin's Paul Anderson about the Orion vehicle and how its unique design and features are helping further missions to the moon. Then, for almost 50 years, engineers have been keeping the Voyager missions alive. The two spacecraft have been exploring the parts of our solar system billions of miles away from home. And from over 15 billion miles away, the Voyager team was able to revive thrusters that haven't worked since 2004. We'll speak with Voyager's Karim Badaruddin about how his team is working to preserve a mission in interstellar space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The last time astronauts explored the moon was 1972, and now more than 50 years since that final Apollo mission, humans are gearing up to once again journey back to the moon through NASA's Artemis program. Technology since those Apollo missions has drastically changed, and Lockheed Martin built a new crew capsule to take those astronauts to the moon, the Orion spacecraft. It's got life support systems, tough heat shields, and radiation protections to keep the crew alive. The spacecraft is now at NASA for final preparations ahead of the Artemis II mission that will take the four astronauts on a flyby of our moon, ahead of future human landing missions. I spoke with Paul Anderson, Deputy Program Manager for Orion at Lockheed Martin, about the spacecraft, what Orion and Artemis means for human space exploration, and the unique features that Orion has to keep the crew safe and comfortable on their mission to the moon. Here's part of our conversation now. I'm very excited to talk with you about Orion ahead of Artemis II. Lockheed Martin reached a major milestone with the spacecraft, right? Turning it over to NASA. Tell me a bit about why this is such a big deal for this mission.
It's a just very, very exciting couple of weeks here at Lockheed Martin, getting the Artemis II crew module ready and delivered to NASA. It's been just, I'll say, many years in coming. I mean, the program has been going on for a number of years, but we have been really focused on Artemis II and getting this delivery, you know, especially over the last year. And this really culminates in completion of the major element that the crew will actually be situated in as we go back to the moon for the first time since 1972. So it's very, very exciting, a major milestone for both Lockheed Martin and for NASA.
You are designing a spacecraft to take humans to deep space and back safely. The first time this has been done in half of a century, right? I mean, can you tell me a bit about just how big of a responsibility this is?
It's been over a generation since we last had human beings in the vicinity of the moon or on the surface of the moon. And so, you know, the vast majority of the employees, whether they're at NASA or Lockheed Martin, are literally hundreds of suppliers that have supported this. You know, many of them were not even alive. I happened to be a very small child at the time when, you know, I remember just vaguely remember Apollo 11 when we landed on the surface and Neil Armstrong took that magical first step in July of 1969. But, you know, again, the vast majority of people who have worked on this program and who are following this have never experienced this before. And, you know, we've had a very, very robust space program over the last 50 years. But, you know, again, just the majesty of going back to the moon, what that means for the United States, for this nation, and really for the world, it's not even a once in a generational thing. It is, it's even rarer than that, that we're going to be seeing this moment.
You know, I had a chance to speak with Christina Cook before she was told that she was going to be on this mission. And she was talking a lot about how she's helping NASA develop the training and the development of the Artemis program. I'm wondering, now that there is a crew, what role does the crew play in designing and developing this spacecraft and getting it ready for their mission? Are they pretty hands-on when it comes to Artemis II?
Yeah, the entire crew, Christina included, and all of the Artemis astronauts have been just instrumental in, you know, not only participating in, I'll say, a lot of the design reviews that have gone on, in a lot of the, I'll say, the non-conformances as we have worked through some of those prior to delivery. And then probably the most obvious, they're very involved today in the training, getting prepared to fly this mission, to fly this spaceship. Again, this is a first of its kind that is an interplanetary vehicle that houses a crew since the early 70s. And so there's a lot to learn. Obviously, technology has changed enormously since the Apollo era. And the crew has to learn how to fly this machine. They will do extremely well. Of course, today we have a lot more, I'll just say, computer capability, autonomy capability, all of that the crew does rely on. But when it really comes down to it, we still need the crew to be able to operate this vehicle and the creativity that they bring to the mission. And of course, just having humans being part of this and, you know, what that means to not only the crew themselves, but to everybody who worked on this program.
Interplanetary vehicle. That is a dramatic word, but that is what this is, right? I mean, what are some challenges that you had to take into account when really sending humans to deep space once again? What are the things you have to think about to keep them safe on this mission?
You know, radiation is not necessarily your friend. We have got to make sure that not only do the systems that are part of the Orion spacecraft perform in a space environment, which, you know, we have obviously designed the spacecraft not only to be able to operate to the moon, but also to Mars. It actually has capability to live and operate for that period of time, as you know, enough for, you know, a 2.5 year mission potentially in the future to go to Mars. So we've designed in all of the capability, the reliability, the redundancy. If there is a failure, of course, there's not a local garage shop nearby. We have got to have onboard systems that are backups, that are reliable, that have proven ability to operate in a space environment. And then, of course, be able to keep the crew safe. We have an entire environmental life control system that, you know, allows the astronauts to breathe, allows the astronauts to function within the capsule, you know, an entire crew system for, displays and controls for piloting the vehicle, to be able to, you know, safely land, for example, make sure that the seats are attenuating the landing forces, and, you know, just a lot to take into consideration. And then, you know, obviously for the actual spacecraft design itself, one of the most challenging, if not the most challenging part of the mission is that last, you know, 15 or 20 minutes as we do re-entry. We obviously need to have an extremely safe vehicle. We need to have a heat shield that is absolutely rock solid. We have to have parachute systems, and then all the recovery systems. Once we land into the Pacific Ocean, we have to be able to recover this quickly, recover it safely, and to be able to get the crew, you know, safely out of the capsule in a fairly short period of time. So all of that is extremely challenging, and we have, you know, focused, you know, many, many years of efforts with a very, very large team, both here at Lockheed Martin and at our suppliers, to pull this off.
You mentioned many, many years, Paul, and there have also been some very big milestone missions that have gotten you to this point, right? EFT-1 Exploration Flight Test 1 in December of 2014 and Artemis 1 in November of 2022. Can you tell me a bit about how your team looked at how those capsules performed and what lessons were learned that went into this crew capsule?
EFT-1 flight you refer to back in December of 2014, it was really monumental. It was being able for the first time to prove out, I'll say, some of the core systems of the vehicle. If you think about the computers, if you think about the software, the guidance, navigation, and control, the ability of the spacecraft to autonomously, in this case, it flew a two-orbit mission around the Earth, returned safely within about 4 hours, and it just, I'll say, tested out the core of the vehicle, including the structure, just make sure that it was, that we have a good building foundation to build off of. And after we successfully flew EFT-1, then we added more systems. And to fly the Artemis 1 mission, which we did successfully approximately 2 years ago, that added a lot more systems. In fact, we did a heat shield test. That was one of probably the biggest challenges in getting to Artemis 1, but also one of the biggest successes. We learned how to do what's called a skip reentry. We actually flew through the atmosphere, came back out, flew back into the atmosphere, and, you know, prove that the crew will have the ability to safely re-enter from a lunar trajectory and do so safely. And, you know, we took a lot of the lessons learned off Artemis 1 and obviously applied them to Artemis 2, you know, specifically the heat shield being one, and exactly how we fly the vehicle. The heat shield on Artemis 2 is identical to the heat shield on Artemis 1, but we're flying it a little bit differently just to ensure, I'll say, even more success and put more safety margin as we fly it crewed.
There were some concerns after the Artemis 1 mission with the heat shield, right? Have those concerns been mitigated at this point?
Spent between ourselves, NASA independent review team, very large effort, has spent over a year identifying everything that occurred during the Artemis 1 flight. The heat shield actually performed extremely well. And a lot of, I'll say, lessons that were learned there, you know, had to do with, there were some ablation things that were a little bit unexpected, but we completely have root cause. We understand down to the, I'll say, the molecule level, almost what that physics is, and applying it to both the Artemis 2 mission from exactly how we're flying the entry trajectory. And then as we go forward to Artemis 3 and beyond, we're actually doing some slight changes in the formulation of the heat shield to make it even more robust. So yes, those test flights that you refer to, both EFT-1 and Artemis 1, are just instrumental.
And that will happen with Artemis 2, as you mentioned, Artemis 3, taking the astronauts that will go to the surface of the moon into lunar orbit. The stakes are quite high for Artemis 2. What are you going to be keeping a close eye on that you need to learn some lessons on so that you can apply it to Artemis 3 and be successful in getting those astronauts to the lunar surface?
The first crewed Orion is Artemis 2. That is coming up, a flight of early next year on the Space Launch System. Extremely exciting. Again, first time we've had crew into the capsule doing an 11-day mission. What is going to be the comfort level of the crew? How is there interaction with the displays and the controls going to go, the hand controllers? We're actually doing a demonstration early in the mission to kind of a fly around of our upper stage to do some proximity operations demonstration. We're going to learn a lot about how, as we go to Artemis 3, where we actually have to dock with human lander, you know, how are those systems going to be operating? And then, of course, I would just say physiologically, how is the crew going to do? 11-day mission is starting to, you know, that's a fairly lengthy mission. How are all of the new, again, crew systems and environmental life control systems going to be operating? Make sure the redundancy is there. And, going to be learning an awful lot about Orion and how the crew interacts with it and how that functions during that mission.
Paul, I would get angry emails if I didn't ask you about this from our listeners. How is the toilet looking for Orion? Is it ready to go?
The toilet is ready to go. Now, I won't necessarily bog your listeners down with all of the personal details of that, but I have been assured by the crew that, you know, we tend to make light of what we call the universal waste management system. Toilet's probably a better word, but it's important when you're 11 days out there. And, there are other ways to handle, human waste other than a toilet, but they are, I'll just say, this is a much better approach. So I'm sure that, you know, we obviously at Lockheed and NASA are very excited on seeing how that, that system will operate. But, you know, again, crew safety, crew comfort, all of that is extremely important. And that's a really good example.
Much better than the bags the Apollo astronauts had, right?
Much better than storage bags for an 11-day flight.
We'll get serious, Paul, even though waste management is very serious. But finally, as you mentioned, this is the first time in a generation that your team and people like you are working on a capsule that is going to take people to the moon. I mean, can you just put into words what it's like for you and your colleagues to work on a program like this that has such incredible potential for human space exploration?
I think the common theme that I see, you know, whether you're a crew member, whether you're a member of NASA, whether you're a member of Lockheed or any of the contractors, it is the passion for this mission. It is what this mission means, again, not just to the crew and the employees and everybody that worked on it, but I mean, honestly, to the nation. I mean, this is a uniting, we so badly need things that unite both our nation and the world. And you can go around the world to 5 billion people or 6 billion people and ask about, hey, we've got humanity going to the moon. This is something that is uniting. And everybody feels that sense of mission and importance in what they do day to day. I always like to, you know, even tell college students that this isn't going to be a 40-hour-a-week job. You may only work 40 hours, but this is going to be in your heart and soul for the rest of your life. And that level of passion and that level of desire and, you know, really what it means to humanity is what we bring to work every day.
Paul Anderson, Deputy Program Manager for Orion at Lockheed Martin. Paul Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come, keeping a decades-old spacecraft cruising through interstellar space.
So solving the problem of the failed thrusters gave us an opportunity, gave us a set of spares to extend our mission.
Checking in on the Voyager mission and how engineers are troubleshooting billions of miles away. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Launching back in 1977, Voyager 1 and 2 embarked on a mission to explore the farthest reaches of our solar system, billions of miles away from our planet. To put that distance into perspective, it can take over 20 hours for a message from the spacecraft to reach the Voyager team on Earth. But now, after several decades, the spacecraft are starting to show their age, and in 2004, Voyager 1 lost some of its thrusters. But now, two decades later, the Voyager team was able to get those thrusters back online. Our producer Marion Summerall spoke with Voyager's mission manager, Karim Badaruddin, about the mission and how the team got those thrusters to work. Here's part of that conversation now.
Karim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm really glad we are talking about Voyager once again, because some pretty big news broke that the thrusters that have been on the spacecraft that haven't been working since 2004 were fixed after pretty much over two decades. But the spacecraft is so far away, but the Voyager team was able to fix it even though it is in deep space. Kind of walk me through how far away it is and how the Voyager team was able to overcome that challenge of fixing something that is in interstellar space.
Yeah, so we're over 15 billion miles away. It's difficult to wrap my head around that distance, but it's, you know, beyond the edge of the solar system. So we're out in interstellar space. Another way to think about it is it takes more than 23 hours for a signal to reach the spacecraft. And those signals are moving at light speed.
Wow. I mean, 23 hours, when you think about that, that's a long time, almost a complete day. I want to talk about the Voyager mission itself. Karim, when you were last on the show, we were talking about how it's been so incredible to extend the life of these spacecraft that are in deep interstellar space. Now, it was also important to fix this thruster issue, right? Because from my understanding, there was going to be a little bit of a blackout, right?
That's right. The blackout is due to some antenna upgrades at the 70-meter antenna in Australia. The reason for it is upgrades for science that we want to do, L-band science that NASA wants to do, and also upgrades so that we can communicate with the Artemis mission. For most spacecraft out there, this isn't that big a deal because they can just use another antenna. But in the case of Voyager, the 70 meter in Australia is the only one that has the high power S-band transmitter so that we can send instructions to either of the spacecraft. And the reason for that is Australia is the only deep space network antenna that can see Voyager 2. When that antenna is down for something like upgrades here, or maintenance, and all antennas go through maintenance from time to time, we cannot command the Voyager spacecraft. Those upgrades are going to take 9 months. Now, our project manager, Susie Dodd, was able to get a couple of emergency commanding opportunities in the middle of, we get 2-3 week opportunities to command in the middle of these 9 months. But that's not much time. And of course, with our one-way light time of 23 hours, we're going to use those opportunities only in emergency. We have planned for 9 months without the antennas. And the thing about the failure of the thrusters in 2004, what failed was a heater, the heaters for two thrusters, the thrusters that control roll. And that was on our primary roll branch. So we have two branches that control roll. And so in 2004, we switched to the other branch, and it was pretty much, you know, it was in very good shape. And so that branch was able to carry us for two decades, 20 years. And now those thrusters are wearing out. They're clogging. And I think a good way to think about it is, you know, if you had a car and you drove it all day, every day, you'd want some spare tires. And so, you know, we need some spare tires. And so recovering this this failed thruster branch was important to, you know, to have a set of spare tires to use. The trouble is all these tires are worn, but we were not sure that we could get through this long downtime on the thrusters we've been using since 2004. So solving the problem of the failed thrusters gave us an opportunity, gave us a set of spares to extend our mission.
And I mean, again, these haven't worked since 2004. So kind of walk me through how hard it was fixing these thrusters. How did this process, you know, go to getting the thrusters back up and working properly?
It was a little bit of genius, honestly, from one of our engineers, Bob Rasmussen, who's retired, but came back to help us. And he actually worked on Voyager spacecraft before launch. He had the insight to consider that the problem might not be in the heaters at all. Since two different heaters failed at the same time, he suspected the problem might be electronic and that we could simply command the electronics and recover the heaters. And he was right, but it required his knowledge of how the intricacies of the system actually work. And in terms of actually fixing it, that part was kind of simple. You know, it was send a command to turn on the heaters, basically. And there you go. And you might say, well, gosh, you know, why didn't anyone else think of that? But there's a lot to it. It really does take a rocket scientist sometimes.
And Kareem, when we had you last on the show, you mentioned that because these spacecraft have been in use for almost 5 decades, you're having to kind of go back and learn about the original design for these spacecraft and what those rocket scientists and engineers and scientists in general were thinking at the time. You know, how does some of these original design plans and things like that play a role in what you're doing today?
Those of us who are working on the mission now, with the exception of Bob Rasmussen, weren't around at the time that this spacecraft was designed. We're basically using a machine, kind of like, you know, a person who drives a car. It doesn't take intimate knowledge of the engine and the design to drive a car. You just need the key and, you know, off you go. And that works fine until something on the car breaks. And now you need someone who knows about the car, or you've got to educate yourself about the car. And that's where we are with the Voyagers. And for the most part, we've had to educate ourselves about the designs, software, and all of that to solve the problems. Everything was fine till stuff started to break. And that's where we have to really take a deep dive into the design and the documentation. And they did an excellent job. The designers and the people who built the spacecraft did an excellent job of documenting what they had done. So it's a real needle in a haystack problem. We can go back and look at the documentation, but there's hundreds of thousands of pages. And so you've got to find the right, the stuff that really applies to the problem you're trying to solve. And sometimes it takes a while to find, but to this point, we've been able to find what we needed to keep going.
Right. It's all worth it at the end of the day to think like a rocket scientist, like you said.
Oh, absolutely.
It really takes a whole team. I wanted to ask, you know, this is obviously a huge feat, right? I mean, again, these thrusters haven't been working for over 20 years. What would have happened if you hadn't restored them?
Well, then we would have been dependent on the single set of thrusters that have showing signs of clogging. And so we don't know exactly when they'll be completely clogged. And when they're completely clogged, they stop working. And when they stop working, that's when we lose our ability to point at Earth. So you're talking about the challenge. You were asking me about the challenges of communicating with the spacecraft. It's really pretty simple. We send a radio signal to the spacecraft receives it, and vice versa. And as long as we point at the spacecraft, which we can control pretty well here at Earth, and as long as the spacecraft points at Earth, which it can control pretty well, as long as its thrusters are working, this communication is pretty simple. If the thrusters fail, then the spacecraft can no longer point at Earth and we can no longer communicate with it.
And again, the spacecraft collects data and information like no other before, right? So I know that we've talked about that in your passions of trying to continue the life of this mission to get it to 50 years. We're almost there. I guess now we're possibly even looking at more than that, right? Because now there's another solid backup just in case with these thrusters. And it just kind of stands the testament of time that the Voyager mission is really part of our space history. It's almost 50 years old seeing some of the earliest missions going on then and into now, where we're seeing rocket launches almost every day. It just really stands the testament of time, right?
Exactly right. And 50 years, you know, it's just a nice round number, but we're returning data from a part of space, you know, outside of our solar system that we've never visited until now. You know, it's so difficult, took so long to get there. I'm not sure that we're going to send spacecraft out there again. And so every bit of data that we return from this space is precious. And so continuing past 50 years as long as we can is very important, since we're already there. To continue to return this data, you know, and I'll actually give my wife credit for this because she brought it up. But it's something that I've heard from the scientists as well. You know, one day this mission, both spacecraft will stop. We are power limited. And if some other failure, if the thrusters, if we're able to keep the thrusters going, if we're able to stay warm enough, eventually we will run out of power and we will not be able to... The spacecraft will not have enough power to do all the things it needs to do to stay pointed at Earth, to keep the instruments powered, all those sorts of things. But the spacecraft are in orbit around the center of our galaxy, and they will continue in orbit forever. And, you know, the Earth will eventually end. You know, the sun will run out of fuel, and I'm not sure of the timeline, but something like 5 to 7.5 billion years. And then the sun expands and swallows up the Earth. I don't know. I don't know what that is, but ultimately the Earth becomes uninhabitable, right? But these two spacecraft continue in orbit around the center of their galaxy, and they may well outlive us. Outlive the Earth.
That's just fascinating that they could outlive the Earth. And on a personal note, Kareem, I have to say, you and I have talked on the show before about the Voyager spacecraft. We've talked about how crucial it is, about the science. You know, when those thrusters did come back online, how did you feel as somebody who's so dedicated to this mission?
Well, joyful. We were hoping it's kind of, those of us who are on the mission have heard for a long time that these thrusters are failed and cannot be recovered. And then when we had this inkling that they just might be recoverable, you know, did we dare to believe it? And, you know, it was so important that they do work that we took the chance of testing them. And when they did, it's just wonderful, just joyful that, oh yeah, this really will extend the mission. This really is the chance we were hoping for. It's difficult to describe. It's hard to find the words. Getting a second chance when we didn't think we were going to have one.
Getting a second chance when we didn't think we were going to have one. I love that, and I'm so happy for your team. Kareem Badaruddin is the Voyager Mission Manager. Kareem, thank you so much for talking with us today and kind of sharing a really interesting and just uplifting news about Voyager.
Yes, it's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, NPR's app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook. Our handle is at @AWTYSpace. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you'd be a good guest, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage is online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? It is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Ashley Reed. Ashley, welcome to the show. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.